Hello, Emmy Man.
Hello, Ted Leo. Ted Leo, welcome to the podcast that we do together called The Art of Process.
Thank you for welcoming me to our podcast.
First of all, I'm going to turn you up in my headphone because we're communicating remotely. Oh, good. Oh, my God. I have you on FaceTime on my phone on the dumbest little tripod that is just beyond useless. I don't know why. I just don't prop it up on some books.
I have mine gaff taped to the top of my computer on which I'm also recording this conversation.
So. You know what? That's probably what my move should have been. Why buy a dumb little tripod when you can just gaffer tape it to like an existing mic stand or something?
Yeah.
I think it's time that we re-upped our, what would you call it, mission statement or our...
Sure. Elevator pitch.
Hate. Just to tell people what the podcast is about.
Mm-hmm.
In short, being an artist is not some magic thing that is just visited upon you by a wizard. It's a product of a kind of alchemy that comes from doing actual tasks and work and practice and learning forms and structures. And in that way, you get inside what you're doing and then, you know, you express yourself because it's inevitable that once you do these things, you will express yourself in some way.
And it's acting. It's not solely things acting upon you.
Yeah. It's not a passive thing. It's an active thing.
Now, normally you and I would gab before we introduce our guest, but I want to mention our guest for this week first because I want to talk to you about something as it relates to what our guest does. She's the television critic at The New Yorker, Pulitzer Prize-winning writer, critic, author. She's done many, many things. Our guest is, of course, Emily Nussbaum. Game of Thrones just ended. I'm sure all of our listeners were all watching simultaneously. All of our listeners except for you.
Yes, as you know, I was one of the few people who never jumped on board that dragon train.
Never rode the dragon.
I'd never chased that particular dragon.
Emily Nussbaum did watch it, and she has a piece in The New Yorker about it. And she, while enjoying the show, seems kind of indifferent about it, and I find that slightly hard to believe. Most people that I know were either all in or all out.
On the show itself or the
show
ending?
Itself. Yeah, the show itself. But what I wanted to bring up was, as regards the ending, have you seen this thing going around where there are, you know, hundreds of thousands of people have signed this petition to get them to rewrite the entire final season?
I mean, I just don't know what you expect to accomplish by such a petition.
I mean, maybe it's tongue-in-cheek. Maybe it's done understanding how absurd it is. But the idea that someone would... Now, I am not a fan of this final season. I'll go on record as saying that I have a lot of problems with it. And they continue all the way through the end.
But you're happy to go about your day.
Yeah, well, more than that.
And go like, that didn't do it for me, but, you know.
I'm not of the mind that I get to demand a rewrite of a piece of art that's been made. You know, what I get is to be disappointed. That's part of the deal.
That's right. You get to be disappointed.
Right? Yeah.
You get to have your own opinions about how it should have gone. Yeah, you get to have the feeling of disappointment that you wish somebody had made you feel a different way and that didn't happen. Demanding a rewrite, surely no one could think that we'll accomplish. Like, obviously, nobody's going to rewrite and then refilm a thing. So it must just be like an impotent show of disapproval that is like, well, this is all I get, sign.
Yeah, it's either a cheeky but impotent sign of disapproval or evidence of wild entitlement rampant in, you know, internet culture these days.
Yeah, maybe a little of all of it.
But you know what has come out of this being a relatively disappointing season is some good writing, some good actual criticism. And it got me thinking about, it's part of why I wanted to bump this Emily Nussbaum interview up in our schedule, because it got me thinking about the role of criticism and what criticism can give us, and criticism that's not just a review of something, but criticism that actually sparks critical thought. And what a great thing it is that sometimes you get to be disappointed, and then you get to poke at that. You get to try and figure out why. You get to understand,
yeah,
you know,
what... Totally agree.
So, yeah, I don't know if you have any thoughts about that higher higher realm of criticism.
Well, I find it that it's entertainment in its own realm to write about a thing that everybody is talking about. I don't even know Game of Thrones, but I enjoy people's writings about it. I mean, you know, like Andy Daly's recaps of Game of Thrones and Vulture, like, I loved that, and I did not need to watch a minute of it to enjoy it. One of the things I really enjoyed about our podcast with Emily was that she has very definite ideas about her process, things she does when she's stuck, steps that she takes to make a thing better, things that she over the years have learned, like try this, try that, try that if it's not working. And I think that's really great. Like, that's really, there's something that's just so exciting to me about seeing a person figure out how their craft works and how it can work better for them. And I guess that's why, like, the podcast is interesting to me in general, because, you know, I feel like I personally get a lot out of hearing how other people's craft works for them and what, you know, what tricks they use. And just kind of knowing that as you do something more and more, you start to figure this stuff out.
I agree. In a lot of ways, Emily was the perfect guest for this podcast in that she does have so many of her systems and processes down and can articulate what they are, you know.
Unlike, and she's in, yeah.
Unlike exactly. Where we land sometimes, where we're like, sometimes I sit for a while, I try to do a thing, and then I, you know.
An idea comes to me, or. Yeah, exactly. And she's very enthusiastic about it, too.
Setting up the scene, it's like dearth. Dearth is one of those words that I'm always like, does it mean what I think it means, or does it mean the exact opposite of what I think it means?
Are you recording and we're getting a little pre-roll conversation?
Yeah.
A little mise-en-scene, as it were.
Dearth is just the complete lack of the
right,
thing.
Right, complete lack of, yeah. Okay, thank you. It doesn't mean the exact opposite of what I think it means.
Like a surplus, like, right. Yeah.
Yeah. A friend of mine, when she was young, would see a word over and over and in her mind pronounced it wad unit.
Sorry, say that again?
A friend of mine, seeing a word over and over in reading, pronounced it wad unit.
Why unit?
Who done it?
Oh, that's amazing. Yeah. I actually had this thing. I once wrote about this because I wrote a column about them. But for years, I thought that there was a style of television that was a grand epic story that had really big plot points and often a huge budget and went over several episodes and was kind of a grand thing. And I thought it was a whole genre called a miniseries. And I had no idea.
Oh my God, no.
That it was miniseries. And I was very disappointed because a miniseries is like a small series. And right. So it actually, whereas miniseries sounded amazing to me.
Miniseries sounds extravagant and sprawling. And
I thought that's what it was. I was like, the Thornbirds, the miniseries. Right. Like,
fantastic.
So Thornbirds is the original miniseries in a way, right?
Right.
I mean, let's discuss television.
I'm always happy to discuss television. I'm trying to, there was this whole period when there were a bunch of miniseries.
Yeah.
because it was like the Thornbirds, there was Roots. What was the one set in Japan? Shogun.
Yeah. All those James Clavell.
There was Holocaust. And some of them were more like the Thornbirds, where it was like an amazing soap opera that had a very big budget and was really sexy. And some of them were more kind of educational, everybody should watch this at once kinds of things. And of course, the whole thing has changed because now you have cable and they can show a one season series that has this grand historical thing and it doesn't stand out. But at the time, they were like special events.
Yeah.
Emily Nussbaum, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
This is very exciting.
For me too.
The first and maybe the most obvious one is the role of limitations, an assignment, a deadline, a specific thing that you have to write about, which, you know, is the thing that you are known for doing. How do you feel that that impacts creativity? Are you dying for a completely blank page with no idea of where you're going?
No, I definitely am not. I don't know what would happen, though. I was about to say I love deadlines. I find them really helpful psychologically and emotionally. But then, I've been a journalist for a while, and so maybe I'm just used to them. Like, maybe I would function in a different way if I had more endless space. But, I mean, I think a lot of journalists are like this. Like, I do take pride in getting the thing in. And I just build up systems so that I because I'm not really a first draft writer, I build up systems so I can trick myself into making it high enough quality that I don't feel incredible despair about having it land in print, because eventually it does have to go in. It's funny. I was just talking with another friend who's a movie critic, and I was complaining to him because I was saying, I feel like my best insights and funniest lines and the things that I feel just are cool in a column often come in the last draft, literally as we're closing the piece, I'll come up with something. And he said that he had the opposite, where he would kind of brood about the subject he was writing about. But by the time he wrote the first draft, he had first draft energy, and it would sort of come out in that space. And then when he was reviewing it, he would make the writing better, but the actual insights and twists and turns came in the first round. And I was so jealous, because I actually do feel like I'm a three draft writer. But when I have four drafts, that's when I get a good piece. So what I do is my pieces, I mean, this is just about columns, because obviously I've written other kinds of journalism and features and things. But for columns, the column closes on Tuesday generally in the magazine, which means, you know, at that point it's completely gone through fact check and copy edit and several rounds internally. So what I try to do is turn it in Thursday or Friday the week before. And usually in that case, I'm turning in something that is not a terrible draft, but is kind of rough. And I force myself to turn it in, even if it's a first draft. I don't get a lot of notes from my editor. I'm literally just doing it to make myself feel like I have a first draft that's in. So I pass it, I email it to my editor, and I just say, could you just run your eyes over this and tell me if there's something disastrous about the structure, or if you basically understand what I'm doing.
And you're still working on your next draft. You're not waiting for those notes from the...
Actually, I do.
Oh, you do? Okay.
Like I take a little psychological break, and then when he writes back and generally says, yeah, this looks good. I mean, sometimes I'm just sort of looking for if it's super confusing or if there's something garbled or vapid or a little bit glib about, like, my approach. I mean, but he doesn't actually give me notes on the lines. He just says, yeah, it looks basically fine. I was a little confused about whatever. And then I take it, and then usually over the weekend, I turn it into a second draft, and the second draft is a publishable draft where I actually feel like it has a good lead, it makes a set of arguments. I write two lengths of columns, so I have these little rules in my head for how to fix things when I get stuck. And then by Monday, it's a second draft, and then I sort of go into a weird overdrive of panic from Monday to Tuesday where I'm just desperate to fix whatever the problem is that I see. Either the language is really flat, or I feel like the argument I'm making is unoriginal, or it's a little over-egged with too many plot details and stuff like that. And so I try to fix it, and I do it all sorts of different ways. But I basically force myself to do three drafts. And actually recently, two times I did this process, but all within 36 hours.
Oh, wow.
So I forced myself to go from a first draft to a second, and I did it, and it came out just as good. But it was torture. So I basically, wow. I mean, it was, but on the other hand, there was a little part of me that was like, maybe I should do this because it actually makes the week easier in a different way. I can watch a lot of TV and read and do other things. And then if I just like hammer this out and kind of stay up late and all of this kind of stuff just to make it go. But I think other people are more easy first draft writers, and I'm just not. I never have been.
In a recent review of Shrill that you wrote, I remember you said in that, I almost didn't write about it. And in thinking about this process and sending notes to an editor, I'm wondering how often you get ahead of the assignment curve culturally or specifically with regard to the magazine itself. Are you being handed assignments? Are you bringing your ideas of what you want to write about to the table? And how often do you find yourself ahead of that curve or behind the curve?
First of all, I pick pretty much 95% of what I write about is me saying I want to write about it. I have conversations with my editor, and I often will send him a handful of upcoming shows and say, which of these things seem most interesting to you? But generally, I don't get assigned things. And when I first started the job, I had this idea in my head about the column, because it's an every 2 weeks column. And then usually every few months, I do a longer kind of thinky, researchy essay, or I do a big profile or something. But by and large, they're either 1350 or 1600 to 1700. So that's what I'm dealing with, is every 2 weeks. But I picked the shows. And when I started, I had this very straightforward, little rigorous idea where I was like, you know, my basic plan is I'm going to alternate week to week from comedy to drama, from cable to network, from big show that everybody's talking about to little gem that I want to draw attention to. And every 4 or 5 weeks, a mixed or negative review, because the job of a critic is really not to just be like, watch this, watch this, watch this. And when I do a negative review, I want it to be something that there's a reason beyond just that the show's bad, that I'm actually saying something about TV. So I actually had this really nice idea. And then TV started expanding. And at this point, it's just freaking triage. Right. Like, I'm literally just... And, you know, I had all these little problems at the beginning where I was like, do I write about a drama at the beginning of the season to turn people onto it? Or do I write about it 2/3 of the way through when I can actually get into stuff? When do I spoil things? Can I write about it after the season is over? Like, all of these kinds of things. But honestly, I think all TV critics would say this. Like, at this point, we're all just G-chatting with each other saying, have you seen anything that's good? Because you otherwise, you'll miss things. Yeah. And I can't keep up with everything. So... yeah, it was funny with Shrill. I did. I watched a few episodes, and I don't remember what did I exactly say. I said that it was that kind of first person dramedy that I was getting a little.
Yeah, if I remember correctly, I think you questioned writing about it because I think you were just having trouble finding a place to sink your teeth into what to write about it.
Well, the thing is, there's so many first-person-based shows that have this slightly indie film feel that are half-hour shows on cable that are short seasons that. I think a lot of people were getting a little burned out on them. And then I watched it and I was like, this is incredibly charming and warm and smart in subtle ways. It's not showy, but it's just a good show. Yeah. It's a good new show. So I was really happy to write about it.
This jumps off from the question about what you choose to write about versus, you know, being assigned things, but you chose to write about TV early on. And that's obviously something that
although
is really,
in a weird way, it wasn't even really early on. Like it was, I mean, I have this very straightforward thing. Like I got into journalism when I was in my late 20s. I mean, I could talk a whole story about journalism and stuff. And I actually wrote other kinds of criticism early on. Cause at one point I was in graduate school for poetry and I was writing about academic subjects for this magazine, Lingua Franca. And there's this weird quality to journalism, especially at the time where I always said, apparently if you write about something twice, you're an expert. So it's actually a nice, honestly, it's part of the reason it was a good profession for me and good I left graduate school because journalism is good for dilettantes who can't concentrate and jump from thing to thing. And
That's
so graduate school is good for, you know, introverts with a deep focus who can retreat with an enormous set of texts and write in a certain way. And I'm much more in the journalistic mode on that. And so at the time, I wrote reviews of books and also of poetry, and I love poetry. But I've talked about this before. I wrote several reviews of poetry books for the New York Times Book Review, and I just felt tortured by it because I actually felt like it was almost unethical to write poetry reviews because poetry was read by a tiny amount of people. It was made by one person in a very personal way. It made no money. And a review in the New York Times Book Review had such a significant impact that it felt like I couldn't write a mixed or negative review without feeling really cruel.
Yeah.
And so I was like, but you can't review art unless you're willing to say negative things. It's ridiculous. Then it's just puffery. And so I actually retreated from it and started turning down assignments on that. And I thought, oh, I don't really want to be a critic because it actually feels like a mean thing to be. But both I got meaner as I got older and I decided that television was the opposite of poetry. Yeah. I just was personally interested in television. It wasn't actually that I was interested in criticism. I'm not a person who came up reading a lot of essays and criticism. I always say that television critics always have backstories like supervillains. Like there's a formative show that made them really freaked out. And for me, it was Buffy. And if you talk to other TV critics, they all have like, it's Deadwood or something, or like, you know, a particular show. But for me, it was that I became an insane Buffy the Vampire Slayer super fan in the late 90s.
Oh my God.
And I loved the show in a way that really was not a critical way. It was genuinely like I had not been a fan of something in that way. I mean, this is past. I love the show, but I don't have this feverish, insane dynamic. And I was very into it online and I would read things and like looking for excuses to write about a thing I liked. But that was at the time also of the rise of The Sopranos. And I loved The Sopranos. I was a major fan of that show. But I was very agitated by what I saw as the different critical receptions of these different kinds of shows. Mm-hmm. The way that The Sopranos was praised as great art, as adult, as something that was like a movie, something that was like a book that had transcended television. The New York Times published a book about it, and that Buffy was condescended to and treated as junk, as feminine, as juvenile. So that's why I became a TV critic, is literally that. Wow. Thing, because I was just out. I was in graduate school and then working as a journalist. I was just out at bars arguing with people.
So you might as well argue on paper. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. A lot of interesting things for me in your process. Do you think that the pressure of having turned in drafts helps? I don't know. Like, is panic a necessary ingredient where you're like, oh no, I turned in a draft. Yes, it was competent, but. But your mind starts obsessing about it, so you do come up
so
with...
So once it's like there as a flawed, terrible thing that will shame me by going out in public, then I have to fix it.
Yeah.
Well, I've talked to my husband about this, because every 6 or 7 columns, I have one that I get really stuck on. Uh-huh. Most of the time it goes smoothly, and I kind of know how to get over bumps, but then every once in a while I hit one and I do experience some kind of genuine mental panic about it. But I just have come up with ways to, you know, I'm like, it has to be in one way or the other.
Yeah.
So I have come up with tricks to fix the problem. So
this is what we are all about.
Well, first of all, there is this sense of like, I've been through this before and I've been blocked on a piece, but I would say 70% of the time, the problem is rewriting the lead, which is so ridiculous. Why don't I just do it in the first place? Why don't I just rewrite the first paragraph?
Right.
But sometimes I'm very attached to the first paragraph and I don't think that's the problem with the piece. And then I slowly melt down as I can't figure out how to fix the column. And then finally I just give in and I open a new file and I just rewrite the lead. And then, you know, honestly, that's most of the time. Then the second set of things. I mean, I wouldn't say 70%. I would say like 60% of the time. 20% of the time, the solution is to just be honest about how I feel.
Wow.
Because some of the time I think I'm blocked on what I'm saying. I know it's criticism, but it still requires a certain level of candor. And sometimes I'm paranoid about how what I feel about a thing is going to come across. Sometimes I'm confused about it. Sometimes I'm emotionally confused. And most of the time, the fix is literally just to say it in a stupid, blunt way on the page. And then that clarifies to me what to do. And then there's also this other thing, which is just about my columns, which is a 1,350 word piece can only have an idea and a half. And a 1,600 to 1,700 word piece can only have 2 to 3 ideas. And a lot of the time, because I'm a little bit of a thinky rather than a impressionistic writer, I glop it up with too many abstract ideas. Mm-hmm. And I just look at it and I think, what are the 2 most interesting ideas? And then I just try to slow myself down and say, describe a scene, think about a performance. And I'm recently, especially, I've been trying to challenge myself at like, there are things that I think I'm good at, and there are things that I think are really hard and I'm trying to be better at. And one of them is, I don't have a cinema studies background. I'm not a film critic. I come into this literally because I'm passionate about TV as a medium. And so TV has gotten much more directorial during the time that I've written about it. And I need to raise my game at actually describing how things are directed. And I try to do that in very clear language. Like, I don't come at it with a deep technical knowledge.
Right. You'll say that this shot shows this.
Right.
I've seen that in your writing.
Yeah, exactly. Like, and there's other people who would definitely write about it in a different way. Like, they would know the technical reasons. But I really am trying to pay closer attention to both the editing and the visuals, because not only, I mean, you know, there's all sorts of economic, historical reasons why TV was more of a writer's medium than a visual medium. Frankly, for pragmatic reasons based on the industry, didn't have that much visual variety in it. And part of what I was trying to do when I was first writing about TV was to actually celebrate shows that didn't look good, but were in fact interesting. Mm-hmm. But more recently, I'm like, I have to be able to get across to an audience what's powerful and different and specific and about how something looks and how it affects the themes and all that kind of thing. The other thing I'm trying to do more is talk about performance, because I realized I sort of worship actors who are good, but I cannot figure out what they're doing. And I think it's hard visually to describe why a performance is incredible. So I'm trying to push myself to do that. And I've done that a few times this year in a way that I thought was good. So it's like, I'm just trying to find the weaknesses and the ways in which I'm a little chicken-hearted about talking about certain things.
But I think that comes through in your writing, the fact that you are passionate about what you are writing about. There's a fear of criticism, I mean, speaking as a musician, that is sometimes justified, sometimes not, that the critic is
a hater.
Is sometimes writing more for one's own self-aggrandizement. I'm the first to write about this. I have the smartest take on this. My authority is the final authority on this. And you have a conversational style, I think, in your writing that invites conversation, frankly. And I think the best music writing does that as well.
I mean, I think the relationship between artists and critics is inevitably fraught. It's just an unavoidable thing. Yeah. There was this whole blow up in the last 2 weeks about artists complaining about critics online. Mm-hmm. And there was this big back and forth on Twitter about it.
I saw some
and,
of that.
And yeah. I mean, my feeling about it, maybe this is, I'm not being sufficiently protective of critics or something, but I was kind of like, why wouldn't artists be right. bothered by this? They're allowed to say things. Like, obviously, they shouldn't set hordes of their followers on random freelancers to try to destroy their lives. That's petty, and it doesn't even look good for the artist. That's bad. But I'm proud of what I write about, but I also do feel like it's for, and I think a lot of critics feel this, it's for the audience and not for the artist. But all sorts of weird motives sneak into, well, art in general, but definitely to criticism. It's just the nature of the thing. It's funny, Tony Scott, who writes about movies for The Times and wrote a really wonderful book on criticism, he has this really strong argument for criticism as an art form in itself. And I'm proud of what I create, but like, I actually do think that it's parasitic. Uh-huh. Like, I don't have a problem with that.
Right,
I mean, some artists benefit from critics, but artists don't need critics. Critics do need art. Like, that's just the nature of it. Like, I'm responding to things. But in my case, I have a slightly psycho sense of mission, which perhaps will dissolve over time. Who knows? But it, to me, when I started writing about television, it was because I thought, well, first of all, in a kind of snotty arguing in a bar way, I was like, people are misunderstanding what makes certain things good and other things, you know. But then also, TV has historically a condescended to art form. Mm-hmm. It, you know, spent decades from its beginnings as something that was treated not as art, but as garbage, as candy, as cigarettes, as an addiction, as something that messed up your brain. So I felt like criticizing television and saying what was good and what was bad was a way of praising television. Yeah. So that was my way into it, was this sense of like, I'm not writing about an individual show or an individual creator. I'm writing about television in general. Now, for an individual TV creator, I'm sure it doesn't feel that way when somebody pans them. But, you know.
I do agree that criticism certainly can be art. I mean, literary criticism is probably the best example of that. There are people who have made long academic and writing careers out of literary criticism. Art creates culture, informs culture, advances or detracts from culture, and criticism does the same. It's part of the same matrix.
Yeah. It's funny because everybody, when they talk about what they do, suddenly gets incredibly self-conscious. They're like, what am I doing? What am I contributing? But the conversational thing is important to me, partially because part of my whole goal was to have a language about television that was not about comparing it to books and movies, but was talking about what TV is as TV. And because TV, less so recently, but historically, was something that was an episodic art form that took place over time, it was itself conversational because the audience would react to an episode and then another episode would come out and the creators would be affected by the ratings, by the conversation, by the criticism, and then their show would change. So I'm sort of obsessed with the idea that TV and TV criticism are social. And that's part of why I think this is, I mean, it's an interesting time for writing about TV because TV has changed so much. Yeah. It's become so central, but also because the internet has completely altered people's relationship with television. And I'm a kind of a digital minded person. And so I'm always wrestling with that and trying to figure out how to write about it. Cause it does seem like it's the central phenomenon of our time, but I don't know. It's just a funny thing because I mean, I don't feel panicked about my writing, but I do feel a little agitated about understanding what's happening in front of my eyes, because TV, even in the last 4 years, has changed so much that a lot of my pet theories are like, what is streaming? Like, how can I write about the difference between a streaming show? I mean, I've always been very into trying to talk about the way TV shows are made and how they affect what they're saying, like the structure of the shows and the way that shows can be formulaic, but formula can be a wonderful thing. Mm-hmm. There's something very powerful about, I don't know, the whole thing is just in turmoil. And when people talk about the TV industry, I'm always like, if I understood anything about economics, I would not have gone into arts criticism. That seems, you know, so it's like, but so much of the industry is shaped by all of these changes in advertising and distribution and, you know, so all I can do is respond to whether I like the show in this sort of naive way.
So being a critic in this field evolves along with the form itself then.
Yeah.
You have to adapt your own thinking and find new ways of understanding what you yourself are doing in relation to it.
And by the way, my biggest influence as a TV critic, and I can name writers that I like, but it's Television Without Pity, the website that was just anonymous threaded conversations about TV shows. It's dissolved. Wow. It was bought by Bravo and then it turned into like a horrible, puffy, zombie version of itself. But for a while, when I first got into TV, I mean, I was a freelance writer.
Right.
So I was online a lot. And it was a fascinating, I mean, it had insane threads, not just about Buffy, but any show. That's where my ideas about not just TV, but criticism came from. Because there's a certain kind of theatrical voice that is part of online writing that I think is great. And, you know, it's funny, writing for The New Yorker, I actually felt like it was great because I often say this. People say, was there a difference in writing for The New Yorker? And I'm like, you have to earn your jokes in the font. Because the font itself makes a certain kind of joke that would work if I was tweeting it.
It's so true. Yeah.
That is fascinating.
Glib or cheap or self-aggrandizing.
Right.
And so I think that trying to get a certain, I mean, not like I write like an online person in the magazine. I think I write, you know, essays or whatever, but like criticism is all about voice. Otherwise, why would you be listening to the person? It has to have that theatrical quality of you're performing your opinion. Mm-hmm. And so the real question is just how to get the sentences to work. And that's the terrible part. Otherwise, you could just say what you thought.
Yeah,
there is, you know, it is a soapbox. And once you are on a soapbox, you have to wave your arms around a little bit.
Yeah.
We're going to take a break and we'll be right back. The Art of Process is brought to you in part by Casper. Casper's new hybrid mattresses combine the pressure relief of their award-winning foam with durable yet gentle springs. I have to say, they sent us a Casper mattress, and I really like it because it's durable, wait a minute, it's soft yet firm. It's firm yet soft. They didn't say that. I'm saying that. Yeah, it's a hybrid mattress. It's pressure relief, durable yet gentle.
I don't know. Sure. That's what it sounds like.
Yeah, I really like it.
Yeah. I was going to ask how it's been going for you, but you must have had a lot of coffee today or slept really well on your hybrid mattress from Casper.
You know, I think I do have trouble sleeping, so when I find a bed surface that I enjoy, I get kind of excited about it. But also I'm having my second matcha green tea, which is perhaps a little strong for me.
That's fair. I am slightly jealous. You know what? So as you know, and as close followers of our podcast's Twitter feed will know, I generally do the announcements on the Twitter feed. And by some of those announcements, especially if they were paying attention a few months ago, they might know that I've been having some lower back problems. And therefore, I'm looking forward to getting a new mattress at some point. As people are listening to this podcast, the very next day, I'm going to be coming out to LA to visit you and do some more work. I'm going to propose something, and just purely in the interest of making sure that we are on point with representing our sponsors well, I think that for the time I'm out there visiting you, perhaps you should sleep in the guest room and I will use your Casper mattress.
Well, I feel absolutely certain that you should and will end up taking a nap on this mattress, though.
Okay, excellent. I will take you up on that. For our listeners, you should know that with your purchase of a Casper, you get 100-night risk-free sleep on a trial.
I think that's really good because you really don't know how a mattress works unless you sleep on it a bunch. You sleep on 100 nights and you're like, it's not working. send it back. You can do that.
Makes you feel like an adult when you purchase a mattress, too, I got to say. If you're a scrub like me who's lived in 100 punk houses for many, many years, maybe you dragged a ratty futon around with you forever. Maybe now you're working a job. Maybe now you're planning on staying in one bedroom for a little while. You want to get a Casper mattress.
That's the thing about the futon. It's just too, it's firm. It's all firm. It's too firm. This is like kind of the two things in one. Also, the thing about it coming in a box, like the box really is not very big. And then it grows. It, like, you unroll it and it grows, and it's such a weird experience, but it's kind of cool.
Listeners to The Art of Process can get $50 off selected mattresses by visiting casper.com/art and using art at checkout.
That's casper.com/art using the word art at checkout. Terms and conditions apply. You posted online, I assume, on this, and that was like practice for you.
I was doing other, I think I was in graduate school when I first got on there. And, you know, I posted on Usenet and things like that, too. Mm-hmm. Like, there was a period when people my age like have all these nostalgic memories of early technology. I don't know how much you guys were online.
Like, I was from the, like, the early 90s, I would say.
Yeah. I mean, I wasn't like a super
those news
on
groups.
News
on
groups.
Those
yeah,
news
Gopher.
Groups. Yeah. Alt, wait a minute, what was
yeah,
it?
Yeah, all those alt forums.
Yeah, the alt forums.
And early AOL chat rooms and stuff.
There are a lot of younger critics I talked to, and they were formed out of fan groups online. Uh-huh. Like, they had this experience that I didn't have, because there were just a lot more, or they were Tumblr people or had their little Zangas and things like that. I mean, before I was a TV critic, I wrote a couple of big pieces about technology and these pieces that I'm proud of but are now weirdly outdated, because the first one is about the idea of generation gaps in digital culture, and so this just dissolved because old people are just as online in good ways and bad ways as young people are now. But yeah, that online conversation about TV, which included, you know, I hate recapping, but recapping was a big part of you know, the formation of TV conversation. And then there's also fan sites and how fans respond to television is so interesting to me, because, like I said, my primal thing about TV is how TV changes over time and responds to its own audience, and it's sort of like is a tape medium but also a little bit of a live one where you see it being worked on in a funny way.
Yeah.
And you could really see that happening in terms of how people responded to things online. So I'm actually obsessed with TV shows that started incorporating literal references to their online audiences, which is often really dangerous and not a great idea. But
it seems like a very bad idea.
It is a very bad idea, with Lost as the, like, to me, Lost was a show that got a little destroyed by the responses of its creators to the fan base of the show. Mm-hmm. But then Damon Lindelof, one of the creators, made The Leftovers, which is one of my favorite shows. And I always regard that as, like, you know, there's this great thing about it. That show is related to Lost. It's responsive to the conversation about Lost, but it's totally different. And it's just an amazing accomplishment. And it's just, I mean, it's not like the show is literally responsive to critics or audiences in a specific way. It's just that it absorbs all of these ideas and feelings.
It absorbs
exactly.
The vibe around it.
It's interesting you mentioned recaps, because I would credit Vulture with the comedians. You see, you use a lot of humor in your reviews.
Can I just say?
Oh, yeah, please.
First of all, I was there when Vulture was created,
and
I was
there.
I was at New York Magazine when Vulture was created, and I remember the line of possible names for it that we had, like Culture Vulture, and we had all of these possible names.
Right.
I actually just found them. I have a list at home from when we were brainstorming the Culture section, and then when the website got created and all that kind of stuff. But Vulture definitely did not create recaps. I just want to give credit where credit is due.
Oh yeah, no, I'm not saying created, but in the extremely online world, I feel like their use of comedians.
Oh,
doing
yes.
recaps of shows really catapulted that into hyperdrive.
I agree.
Paul F. Tompkins
Julie
recapping.
Klausner,
what did he recap?
American Idol.
Yeah.
Which is so hilarious.
In American Idol. Julie Klausner did some stuff.
Oh, she did Smash, right?
Yeah, Smash, of course. Yeah.
That was amazing.
Yeah. But I wonder, like, you as a critic, and you're very funny and you use a lot of humor. I mean, did that rub against
you? No, I'm just personally interested in, I'm like a comedy fan since college, and I'm just interested in humor and comedians in general. So I just think I actually have thought a bunch about this recently, because it's also a crutch, you know? It's like, and I think there's a gendered aspect to it too, where I think I've always been very determined to be funny and tap dance a little bit in print because it reduces a certain kind of aggressive response. And I think a lot of women who are out in public do this. And I think it's understandable. And the thing is, I like being funny and I like when other people are funny. But I think there's part of it that's when you know that you're going to be called shrill or preachy, one of the ways to compensate for it is actually to be light and funny. And I've actually been thinking about it in my own writing where I'm like, is there something compulsive about my need to make a joke in a column? On the other hand, when I read things, I like reading things that are funny. So, but there are pieces where when I'm writing them, I'm like, it's okay for me to just say this in a serious way. Like I'm talking about a serious thing. I think I'm afraid of, in my language, coming off as pretentious, both because I'm writing criticism and I'm writing for the New Yorker. And so there's a little bit of a, if you make a joke, you don't risk coming off as like poety and lyrical in an irritating way, which I think is something that I'm more afraid of than making a glib joke. So when I was in college, I dated a guy who was actually a humor major, which sounds very strange.
Wow. But
it was an individual major and he did stand up. And it wasn't like I ever did stand up or was involved in stand-up or even went to see that much stand-up, but I was interested in both humor and the analysis of humor. And I was a major comedy person as a nerdy teenage girl. I mean, TV was not that good when I was in high school, but what I was into was I was a Monty Python style classic nerd who would repeat Monty Python skits and like did Dungeons and Dragons. Like it was not like an ambiguous situation, but I loved SCTV and I loved Kids in the Hall. And those were the formative influences on me. And I listened to Woody Allen records. Mm-hmm. Woody Allen was, there's a whole thing about Woody Allen, but like, my primal things were Woody Allen, Steve Martin, David Letterman, like dry guys, and a certain kind of cerebral comedy. Those are some of the things I was most artistically interested in. And so they just ended up shaping everything that came after. But that's why some of the pieces I've written that I like the most, they're about pop culture or television, but they actually do have to do with the role of comedy or how jokes work. Like I wrote a piece on Joan Rivers that I feel really good about because it was this cathartic expression of all my mixed feelings about Joan Rivers.
Yeah.
And then I wrote another piece about jokes and Trump and the election that I feel good about. And one of the main things I feel about TV right now is this is not universally true. There are several very good dramas, but the last few years, like, comedy is better and more interesting than drama. Almost, I mean, it's definitely true on network. Like, there's basically no good network dramas. Like, it's hard to find a way to even write about it. But there are some interesting network comedies. And to me, the comedies on cable, I was just rewatching the last season of BoJack Horseman because I'm writing something. And I'm like, this show is so much, it's an animated show that's a comedy, and it's so much more ambitious and aggressive in its style, and visually it's so interesting, and it's just so, to me, that's pretty central to my interest in the medium, and it's just an artistic bias, so it probably leaks into my own desire to be funny. But if you're writing about comedy and trying to be funny, you take a huge risk of coming off like a major asshole, because you're like, I'm writing about a funny person and trying to be funny by myself.
But I think comedy can take bigger risks because you can try different things under the auspices of comedy, where drama really seems stuck in its own formula.
I admire dramas that are able to be, first of all, some of the great dramas are very funny and a lot of the really great comedies are serious. Like that's one of the things that's happened, especially in the last 10 years on TV, is the whole category has gone away. Now it's like half hour and hour long shows. It's like Orange is the New Black. Like, is that a drama or a comedy? Literally, it was nominated in both categories at the Emmys. Well, like the whole thing is all mixed up. But yeah, I do think, I don't like things that are too self-serious because
that's bad.
They don't pull it off that often. Actually, there's part of the reason I was thinking about BoJack Horseman is that I'm not the only one who said this, but there was a spate of comedies that seemed like allergic responses or critiques to the anti-hero dramas that dominated the early part of the century. And they had these dark, dysfunctional male antiheroes, but they were making fun of and taking apart the whole idea of celebrating and glamorizing these guys. But on the last season of BoJack, he appears on one of those shows. He's on the show Filbert, where he's playing like an alcoholic detective with like a shady, it's like detective type thing. But they at one point, the showrunner gets up because they're going to win an award or they're presenting the first episode. And he just says something like, please don't laugh. anything that's funny is not intentionally funny. And then BoJack says, that's always a great way to start a show. It's actually like, it's one of my favorite episodes. It's just personally for me, because it's like an episode where people keep saying things that are just hilariously true things about TV, where he just explains, you got to understand, television is a medium that people make together and then one person takes credit. So anyway, it's just, so I feel like, there are comedies that have been able to, I mean, by and large, the if I had to pick out the shows I like, they have funny things in them more than seriously.
In your own writing, do you run up against fear on the opposite end of the spectrum, fear of coming off as too earnest, too invested sometimes?
Well, I feel like the last 2 years especially, I've been trying to embrace the possibility of just writing something earnest and taking the risk that some people will find it overwrought and other people will be moved or inspired by it or feel like it speaks for them. Like, I wrote a column about the incredible movie The Tale, which I don't know if you guys saw. Mm-hmm. It's really great. And they only showed it on HBO, and I was very frustrated. I think the creator is very interesting. She made this odd personal miniseries before that was on IFC that I had seen that was kind of obscure, but she made this movie that was basically about, she had been molested by this guy as a child, and it was this sort of experimental kind of theatrical movie in which she is revisiting her youth, but she's filming it in these specific ways where it first starts out with like an older teenage girl playing her, and then she looks at photos of herself and she realizes how much younger she was when this happened, and they switch the actress.
Oh my God.
And it's actually very powerful, and I found it personally moving and relevant to a lot of post-Me Too stuff about older women thinking about and reconstructing or reinterpreting things that happened. And when I was writing about it, I was like, well, first of all, this is clearly not a funny subject. There's a way in which you can be dry about certain things, but I actually wanted to say a bunch of like sincere things about like the state of women right now and stuff. And I really found myself as I was writing it, just testing my ability to stay controlled and just say the thing that I wanted to do without trying to escape from it by ducking around the corner or getting super abstract. I mean, I think anyone who creates things, like, they know their own emotional crutches. And I love that column. I think that column came out really well. So yeah, I actually feel like my odd task is to try to be more serious because I think making jokes all the time is good, but also, you know, it's kind of an easy out.
Yeah.
Although the last few columns I went out of my way to make them funny. I was also like, you know, I'm writing about Billions. That's a really funny show.
I read that one.
So it's like, I wanted it to be like juicy. And the other thing is I tend to work blue a lot, and that's funny in The New Yorker, but you can make too many dick jokes and then it becomes its own thing. And
not unlike Billions.
Yes, it is very true. Yeah. Like in Billions, like I think I said he's the cuck to his jock. And I was like, what is happening to the culture where cuck is like a normal word for me to just throw in?
Yeah. We're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back.
Have you ever seen the movie? It's a documentary about war criminals in which the war criminals are made to enact their own crimes.
I heard about that. That sounded a little rough for me, so I didn't see it.
It's raw. It is insane. It's really dark. Really rough. I saw both that and the sequel. They were really fascinating. And anyway, it actually did have some weird relationship to Pen 15 because they're actually acting out their own adolescent traumas. And part of what makes it so powerful is to see the performer performing the thing, but also kind of re-experiencing their own upset and vulnerability. It was a great show.
One of the other things I don't know that made me realize is that women never get those shows. Like, we don't have shows that are about our adolescence in a real way, because, you know, I think there have been things that you just clearly from a man's point of view, like, oh, budding sexuality, like, you know, like that it's like what a dude would think of when he thinks of adolescent girls.
You might get an arc in someone else's show.
Yeah. And there were zero tropes and no very special episode kind of feelings.
Right.
But every episode was a very special episode.
Yeah.
Like every episode you really felt like kind of punched a little bit.
I mean, sometimes I talk with women who make television and they're not so positive, but as a person watching television, it feels like the amount of anarchic female main characters on shows ranging from things like The Comeback or Getting On, which almost nobody watched but had all this stuff, to Broad City and things that are more in people's eyes, like, has been incredible. But it's true that that show, even within the realm of funny women doing more aggressive things, was so original and specific because it was about adolescence. Yeah. Like, Big Mouth has stuff also. Mm-hmm. But this just felt more precise in this funny way.
It was, I mean, that's a piece of art. Yeah. Like, it was really something. And it's like a miracle that a show like that gets made.
Yeah.
Because there's so many moving parts and it's so easy to fuck it up.
Yeah. And also, it was, for a television critic, the most beautiful thing is a good show that's exactly the right length.
Yeah.
Because there are so many shows that are too long or like have this sort of hamburger helper quality to them. And was really great. But it is, in the review, it was fun also because watching the show made me remember all of these things that had this big influence on me as far as, because I love the weird, chaotic, adolescent girl, horny, angry energy in there. Mm-hmm. And so I was thinking about Gilda Radner doing the Judy Miller show. Yeah. I don't even remember on SNL where she'd be like, running away to France, running away to England. And she'd be like smashing into the walls. And then, you know, Mary Catherine Gallagher actually also on SNL where she would like sniff her armpits and stuff. And then also Strangers with Candy, which is the, I've written a bunch about the ability of women to be gross is just this very freeing, great thing artistically. And that's a big thing for women in comedy. And then sometimes people criticize it and they say, oh, they're just going for like cheap laughs by playing dirty. But I don't know. Maybe I'm just a sucker for like every super dirty female comedian. But like,
some women are dirty is the big secret.
Yes.
Like not all.
Women are dirty.
But some are. And it's freeing to see, because it's then you're allowed to be a human being who can be not just one thing.
Yeah.
Also, comedy is often about abasement, and somebody controlling their own abasement and forming it into this kind of theater and self-expression, sometimes autobiographically, but sometimes not. Just, I mean, it's just one of those problems where it's like you just want more of a range of ways to be. Instead of being trapped in this narrow...
I mean, that's very Joan Rivers in a way, right? Like controlling your own abasement.
Although Joan Rivers is so fascinating to me because part of what she was doing, especially early on, and actually her early stuff I do like. She could be very funny, but I also thought she was a really cruel. I mean, I write about this in the essay, her as like the enforcer of women's bodies and rules for women. But her early stuff is all about the contrast between her looking cute and saying what a unfuckable loser she is. Right. Like, and those jokes are raw, that early stuff. Like, they're literally like, a guy won't rape me because he's gagging and wants to vomit. Like, it's like like nasty self-flagellating stuff. And, you know, there's this whole argument for why self-flagellating stuff for women, but in general for comedies, is a dead end or some. But I think that was what she was doing that did feel so liberating, is just the ability for a cute girl in a little black dress with pearls to be like, even I feel like garbage because the system is set up. So like, unless you can get a man to carry you along. So this is like dark, real politic comedy to it.
You're including that essay in your upcoming book?
Yeah, the Joan Rivers one is in there. The book that I wrote, I Like to Watch is what it's called. It's coming out in June. And then what is the sub deck? It's Arguing My Way Through the Last 20 Years of Television or something like that. Arguing My Way Through the Television Revolution. And I tried to choose essays in that book. It includes some new stuff, but the older stuff, I tried to choose things that kind of went with that Buffy Sopranos argument that I'm talking about expanding people's view of what television can do and these sort of repeated themes I've had. But the Joan Rivers thing is just in there because... I like the piece and I'm interested in Joan Rivers. Like, you know, it's hard to put together an anthology because you're trying to make an argument and have the pieces speak to one another.
Right.
But like the piece on the tail is not in there, even though it's one of the things I like the most. Because I was like, you know, a good, fairly serious piece. But also when you look at your old stuff, it's frustrating because I couldn't include all of the things that I thought were good, but just repeated various themes. Mm-hmm. And then there's other stuff I wanted to include. But then when I revisited it, I was like,
Right, because it's not like a greatest hits.
Yeah.
It's a book that's also meant to hang together as a book.
Especially like as an anthology. Like if it was just like everything I ever wrote, then people could be like, wow, that was a terrible piece. What an interesting record of an annoying stage she was in or something. But yeah, I was trying to make them communicate with one another in terms of ideas about TV specifically. So I had to sort of stick to that. But it was a weird process to relook at stuff also because, you know, it's that strange thing where I would read a piece and I think it's about a good topic, but it feels stiff and paranoid. And then there'd be another piece that felt loose and my opinion about it had changed. And I don't know.
Do you always feel like you can do things better? Do you have, what's your perfectionist level?
Well, I was joking with someone the other day about like, you have to hate yourself just enough to get something to be good, but not so much that you never finish it. Like, it's like a very weird.
Pretty profound.
And also the problem is, you know, at what point are you being so self-loathing that you're making your life unhappy? Like, you want to take pride in your work and your creativity. But on the other hand, if you just have low standards and you're like, good enough, one turn of phrase, like that would be bad too. So I have not.
I know
not
people
been
on both
able
sides of
out.
That spectrum, mm-hmm. you know, the write one line, hate it, say I'll never write anything, I'm garbage. And then like, you know, but it's like you don't move that way. You also don't practice that way. I mean, sometimes practice is just writing it as good as it's going to get today. And, you know, also then you develop a relationship with editing, which is, you know,
I'm not even talking about the editing part of it. And that's so central and crucial. And
but I also know writers who just, it's like, I wrote it, there it is. And we're like, do you not want to go back over and maybe try to make that line rhyme? Nothing. That's it. Okay.
That does seem weird to me.
Yeah, it seems really weird to me. Or did you not notice, or you thought it was good enough, or you don't care, or you're just like, look what I did. Well, I don't know.
First of all, I mean, some people really are good at first drafts, and then when they go back and they try to repair it, it gets sort of smoothed out but less alive.
Yeah,
I'm not really like that, but but I think there are people. I do remember when I was teaching, when I was in graduate school, I would teach. There was this certain breed of actually mostly guys who had read a lot of beat poetry and stuff, and they would write things and be like, first, you know, they were very first draft, they were like, it's my honest opinion, and I'm like, it's a piece of writing, like you have to actually
first draft, man. It's like a kink song. Unwritten kink song.
I mean, some of them weren't bad writers or anything, but they were entertaining guys. But like, there was just level where I was like, that's a really dead end philosophy.
Writing a song, it's never going to be, the first draft is never going to be as good, you know, because I know what it's supposed to be. And I know when it's as good as it can be. And sometimes that's not as good as I want it to be. Mm-hmm. But I mean, sometimes there are plenty of songs I've just been like, I'm just not going to get that third verse as good as that second verse or whatever. You know,
but doesn't
whatever
it feel
it
so good when you look at something and you're like, that's it. That's what it should be. And that's what it is.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And it's nice to listen back. Like I'm listening back to an old record because we're reissuing it and I have to write liner notes for it and to go, well, this is actually pretty good. Like, you sort of think like, so something I wrote 20 years ago must be 20 years as not as good. But it's kind of, so I'm really surprised.
It's such a nice feeling.
Yeah. Even things I thought at the time weren't that great because I felt like they were overworked. And I listened to them like, nope, that actually really hangs together, which I just can't believe.
It's interesting to be able to recognize what the sort of peaks and valleys of older work.
You know,
the things that you now would still stand behind, as well as the things that you now would jettison as quickly as possible.
Yeah, and there's a couple of songs I would chuck off if I was able to, because it's like, yeah, that chorus doesn't belong with that verse. Out.
It's also weird with anything because it's like a record of the period in which you created it.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, it's not a journal entry, but it is this odd marker of like you can remember yourself making it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This is a strange thing.
The Art of Process is brought to you in part by Storyworth. Storyworth makes it easy and fun for your loved ones to share their stories, and at the end of the year, they'll get their stories bound in a beautiful hardcover book. Strengthen family bonds, get to know each other in a whole new way. Have you experimented with this at all?
I haven't. I'm actually really interested because I saw ads for this and I was really interested in it. And, you know, my parents are not around anymore, but I was sort of thinking like maybe send it to my brother and have my brother tell his stories because he's the one with the memory in the family.
Right,
he remembers addresses of like, you know, where we used to live, like our various homes and stuff.
I've seen that memory in action.
It's really uncanny. I'm envious and angry about it, but also glad it exists.
I actually did it with my mother. I'll
explain how it works. You purchase a subscription for someone you love, and each week, Storyworth sends them an email with a question about something from their life. They have a broad array of questions. They've done a lot of user research in figuring out how to elicit stories from people, how to elicit talking from people. And then, as you said, at the end of the year, they send you a bound hardcover book. You can order more, obviously, and you can, you know, zhuzh them up with things. But, you know, as the day approaches, one of the pitches from the sponsor was that we discuss possibly using it for Father's Day. I sent it to my mother because, as you know, Amy, her father, my grandfather, had a somewhat unique and very heavy experience in World War II. It was something that he never spoke about until he started speaking about it. And I mean, the man barely spoke at all until he started speaking about this at the very
end.
But
like much later in life, you mean?
Yeah, at the very end of his life. And I got to sit with him off and on, and he would begin telling me things. And there were so many times when I thought to myself, I should record this. I should interview him. You know, I should ask him to tell me his stories. And I never did it. And I'm going to tell you, part of the reason was I think that I was intimidated. I was scared. It felt kind of corny. It was certainly before you and I started doing this podcast, you know, talking to people and eliciting answers from them. And boy, do I wish I had something like this back then. So I passed this on to my mom so she can tell her story and maybe some of his as well. And, you know, it doesn't have to be a parent. A lot of us don't have parents. A lot of us don't have children.
I think it's a very cool idea. And also just the idea of like that they put it into a book at the end.
Yeah.
Like a hardbound book. I think that's kind of amazing. You know, I also, you know, at one point asked my father some questions, recorded his answers, and like something happened. Like the tape was blank. Like something happened to the tape recorder and it didn't register. So that was a sad, heartbreaking experience. Yeah, I'm going to get it from my brother and see like if it, because I think you can modify the questions, right?
You can sort of curate. You probably couldn't even get through all the questions that they potentially have to ask. As the gift giver, you can steer the direction if you want to, you know, focus toward a specific area or specific ideas, that specific things that you know even that have happened in someone's life. And there's no pressure. They try to make it easy for the recipient to spend 10 minutes or so banging a little story out.
I love it. I think it's a great idea. For $20 off, visit storyworth.com/art. When you subscribe, that's storyworth.com/art.
In pulling together an anthology, you're also working with an editor in some
ways?
And are you re-editing pieces?
Well, I did work with an editor who I got along great with, and he's a great guy. It wasn't as intensive an editing process. And in some ways, I like having editing. Mm-hmm. Like, I like having editing for a lot of reasons. I mean, he gave me notes, and they were useful. And I also I wrote a very long new essay for the book that I still feel weird about, but I'm proud of. I think it's good. I was just... When I was working on the book, the Harvey Weinstein expose came. I mean, it was literally when I was on book leave. The Harvey Weinstein piece came down and the Me Too movement started, and it was sort of all I could think about. And I was feeling very traumatized by it and thinking about it all the time. And I was supposed to be writing essays for the book, and that's the essay I wrote. I wrote like a 17,000 word essay considering my relationship with the work of men who did shitty things and how it had shaped me. And it's a little bit of a memoir, and it's thinking about the separating the artist from the art stuff. And
right. And
more than anything, like that piece is a marker of the time in which I wrote it.
Yeah.
You know, I think it holds up and it says interesting things and it's a relevant issue, but it was weird because I was like, I'm writing into this period that's happening and talking about my own experiences. And I don't usually write like first person memoir stuff. And so I found myself like scraping up like what are the origins of my tastes and my fascination with male artists who seem like assholes and do wild things, and my, you know, appreciation for that and the way in which it's sort of shaped me as a person and my voice as a critic and stuff. And anyway, when I was working on that, I actually did send it to several people, and sometimes I sent it to them because I was like, is the writing good here? Does it make sense? And sometimes I was sending it to them because I wanted to get their response to the ideas. And also to try to illuminate, because a lot of times when you're writing stuff that's a little raw like that, I'm like, there may be things here that I'm saying that I don't think I'm saying,
right.
just
mm-hmm.
mistakes I'm making, mm-hmm. like in how clear I am or ways in which I'm being offensive accidentally rather than
yeah.
intentionally.
Yeah, yeah.
like,
yeah.
And so I kind of centered around in that way. This is a very different process than I usually go through. Like I usually just, I have a relationship with my editor. We have a shared language. When he disagrees with things, I love having an editor not like something because sometimes it's bad, but his idea is wrong too. And then I have, then the trick is to find the third thing
right.
that is like payback for him being wrong, but makes the piece better because my original thing was bad too. You, mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? Like
I do,
there's
yeah.
this, yeah, there's this. And honestly, I also like, I brainstorm a lot with my husband who we have a very shared, he's another journalist and we are constantly like hashing things out and brainstorming. I mean, I'm a social person. I like to talk about the ideas out loud. But the book was a little bit different. And he also gave a good suggestions for the order of the book also. Because I was like, you know about books and I don't know about books. He came up with what I thought was a really thoughtful way of arcing it through. But, you know, it's weird. I feel weird about it. I've never published a book before. Anthologies are strange. I'm proud of a lot of the writing in it, but it's an odd experience. I'm used to columns coming out.
Yeah.
And there's something...
ponderous. It's a tome.
Well, here's the problem.
Yeah.
It might be reviewed.
Yeah, oh. Well, that's the other one. Okay, and I have thought about this.
She is on the other foot.
Yeah, she is on the other foot. And look, I've thought, you know, I've actually thought, it's funny because I profiled Ryan Murphy, who I wrote this extended profile of, and I think he's a very interesting creator. He has an incredibly hostile, slightly crazy relationship with critics, as I think he would admit himself, like, which is odd because he wrote criticism when he was younger. So... And I have to say, when I was profiling him, I was a little bit like, you're an incredibly successful person. Like, who cares?
Yeah.
Like,
right.
Also, his stuff has been positive reviewed a lot, but he, like, bears a lot of grudges about things. And now that I have a book coming out, I'm like, oh, yeah, I kind of understand it. Like, I'm sure. But here's the thing. I have panned things. I deserve to get panned. It's just karmic payback.
Well.
Like, I've thought about nobody likes getting a negative review. You know, it's a slightly horrifying possibility. And then I think about, like, the kind of bad review that you could get.
Yeah.
Instead of thinking about the kind of positive review, you think about the kind of bad review. But
sometimes it's the kind of good review you get that can send you into a spiral as
well. Tell me about that. How
well,
so?
You know, just somebody latches on to something in a way that you didn't intend
oh.
or you didn't want. So even if it's technically a positive review, you might be like, I don't want to be associated with that, or that's not what I meant.
Yeah, that's
this,
that's interesting because actually, not to obsess on Ryan, because like
yeah.
lots of people feel lots of ways about reviews, but he was often bothered by reviews that were positive reviews that he felt were either codedly homophobic or didn't get what he was doing. And I was like, I didn't always agree with him. I was like, I think you're overreacting to this phrasing, but I kind of understood what he was saying. It's true. If you get a good review that is framing the thing wrong, but again, I have to, I mean, I will try to bear in mind that the reviews are not for me.
Right.
Yeah. The problem is if you're a critic, like the review probably does seem personal because it's basically like,
Get out your long knives.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's hard. Yeah, it would be hard to not think that like a bad review would be at least a little bit, you know, Schadenfreude chuckle.
I could write a bad review of my book.
Yeah.
But of course, like how self-protective can you be? Like at a certain point, you know, you put your work into the world. But yeah, I mean, I am genuinely saying though, like I'm like when an artist puts their stuff out there and they're being vulnerable and they're putting their creativity out there, it is painful to have people respond. I mean, it's not painful for everybody. Some people kind of thrive
it's
off
painful
it.
To be misunderstood.
Yeah.
You know, it's
yeah,
painful
think, yeah.
in generally, you know, it's one thing to say like, oh, that's not really my taste. It's too this, it's too that. But I mean, I really do tend to just stay away from reviews, period. You know, if somebody sends me something and says they loved it, you know, then I'll read it.
I think that's why.
But yeah, you'll just feel bad. You know, you'll feel bad. And usually it's because they misunderstand something and ascribe to you motives that you did not have or say, you know, a lyric meant something. You're like, I didn't mean that. And that's the painful thing for me.
By way of getting to a broader question for you, the review that made me stop reading reviews for good was a review of an album of mine in 2003 or 2004 or something like that. And it was in a very powerful music publication, and it was very much this one person going through a midlife crisis who wanted to get something from me that I was not going to give them. I was in a different place.
You get a lot of that
in my life.
You get a lot of that. Like you said, you could have been my hero, right. And yet you let me down in this really unspecific way that is only because I had expectations that were totally unreasonable.
Well, and what I think part of what
it's like a lot.
That would be good if that was actually the name of the column, so that you could be prepared and be like, I should probably not read this. This is about this person.
Part of what
issues.
Upset me about it is that I actually appreciate criticism, and I recognize also in this case I recognize the power that it has, and I felt like it was a letdown of the form and the art of criticism as well. I felt like it was a misuse of the form. So for you, what is good criticism? And obviously, I don't mean that in terms of positive reinforcement of art, but what makes good criticism?
You know, it's really hard for me to say because the truth is there's all kinds of criticism and some of which are kinds that I don't write, which is, you know, that review, I do understand why the painful thing is you're then exposed to somebody's public and very personal, where it's like, this is about your emotional draining need of what my art can provide for you. Like, that's too much for an artist. And I haven't read that piece, and it might have been a terrible piece, but there is a kind of piece like that. Like, not to defend the piece, because the piece actually sounds frustrating and self-indulgent.
If the piece presented itself as a personal piece.
As a personal, rather than a review.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
I mean, because I was thinking, like, I have read stuff that are more essays where somebody's struggling with their own response to art that seemed legitimate, but they're a little bit of like memoirs of a response to art. Mm-hmm. I mean, that whole question of like the one kind of thing that I don't like in criticism is I don't like criticism that pretends to be objective. Criticism is not objective. Yeah. Criticism is about one person at one specific time responding to a piece of art. I don't have a problem with criticism that's written in a crisp way that is elegant and doesn't feel personal. And I don't have a problem with gonzo criticism that feels super personal. But I do feel that whatever the criticism is should have, like, even if it's being definitive and even arrogant in its opinions, it should frame itself as an individual response. Because I just, occasionally there are these blow-ups where people are like, criticism should be objective. Like, it should determine whether the art is good or not. And I'm like, that is crazy.
Impossible.
That's impossible. The other thing is, I mean, I do like and dislike all different kinds of criticism. Like, you know, I was going to say, I like criticism that seems informed and thoughtful about the intent of the artist and the context of the art. Like, if somebody's reviewing a sitcom, if they understand something a little bit about like what sitcoms are. But then sometimes I like a weird, naive review that's just an emotional response to one particular thing. So I'm not sure. I mean, but then it just becomes like, I like the criticism that I trust, am entertained by, and find the person thoughtful. But that's just a given.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny because I was going to say I don't like reviews that come off as arch and know-it-all and snotty in a way that I don't feel is earned, but I am pretty sure I've written pieces like that. So like there's a strange quality to criticism, which in the same way that I was saying, like, there's this weird continuum between like, I've got to hate myself enough to make this good, but not so much that I make my life miserable and never finish it. There is this level where it's like good criticism has to have confidence in its own voice enough to actually be a staged presentation of something. It's not like, on the one hand, on the other hand, little me, but if it goes too far in that direction, it does become corrosive and sort of obnoxious. It's like, who do you think you are? Somebody's trying to make something.
Yeah.
And you're just tap dancing all over it.
Another quick break and we'll be back with more Art of Process.
So a lot of our conversations are around the idea of natural talent versus talent that's come from practice and instruction and form and structure. And, you know, so I'm curious as to what your relationship with that was, like if you felt that you always had a talent for writing and what sort of your specific things are that you think you're specifically good at and what you feel like your deficits are and how you get around those.
Aside from being like a weird comedy nerd, I was a touchy-feely Emily Dickinson reading, poetry writing, drama club girl in high school. And I was always interested in writing, and I was always interested in the idea of being a writer. And I didn't know exactly what I wanted to write, but I didn't necessarily definitively think that I was going to be a writer. I actually had other ideas about what I would do, and I did other things when I was younger. I didn't really get into journalism until I was in my late 20s. Part of it, you know, honestly, is like teachers said, you're a good writer. Like that's either a good thing or a bad thing, but I got the message. You know, actually in graduate school, a professor of mine, basically, I don't think he was meaning it to be insulting, but I think essentially he was saying, like, you're probably not a good academic, but you are a good writer.
Wow, that's a thing, though. It's actually very useful.
I mean, he didn't actually say it in quite that way. I was doing okay in graduate school, but it, like, I'm very glad that I dropped out of graduate school. Yeah. Like, I really think that the way that you write as an academic, it's a trap if you want to communicate with people more broadly. But I've been writing for a long time and I do feel like my writing has gotten better. And it's just gotten better because there is like a practice element to it. It's like, you know, you start recognizing your own cliches and trying to be, and you absorb more, you read more, you read other people, you recognize things that are sort of cheap.
Like stylistic things or?
Yeah.
Little trick. Tricks that are...
I said that, and I do think this is true, that criticism like lives off art in a way that is slightly weird for a creative thing. Mm-hmm. And that's true. But there is just an irrational creative element to any kind of writing, and that goes for this as well. And, you know, I do all the things that other creative people do, I think, which is like, you know, among other things, like I face a deadline and then I become anxious and then I need to take a shower or go for a walk, like in order to have an idea come into my head. I write on the subway, on my phone, on the Notes app. I write in Google Docs on my phone because changing it into a different form is helpful, and not being at home in front of my computer is helpful.
Right.
I put little sticky notes on my, not the real ones, the digital ones, on my computer. And then while I'm watching a TV show, I make notes into them. But then if I have an idea, I switch into another document and I like write a paragraph and then I leave the paragraph there because I know I can use it later. Like I have to constantly be knocking myself. Sometimes I, you know, go to the park with my family and in a weird way, ignoring my family while going off under a tree because I get an idea and writing on my phone is helpful. Honestly, I think a lot of people talk about this. Changing the font is helpful.
Yeah.
God, like changing, like making the ruler be smaller and more like a column is sometimes helpful.
I was just going to ask you about that. Because this put this thought in my head, does it ever get into your brain, the visual presentation in the actual magazine, how it's, you know, how it's going to read?
Well, I have one very pathological thing that is not good and I can't solve, but is just true. And my editors, I have talked to you about this because I'm like, you should know that I'm doing this terrible thing. I'm not in general an OCD or even a neat or orderly person, but I have an obsession with making paragraphs look like blocks, and I hate widows, like when it just like two words. So I will tell myself I'm not doing this, but I will edit something, like cut a word or change a word so that it pulls up.
Even when it's in a draft.
It's not even in the, I would understand it if it was like in the printed layouts, but I'm literally doing it in Google Docs. But you know something? I've been doing this for years, and apparently I'm making edits that are not horrible, so it's not like I'm ending up with terrible things in there, but it is, I mean, you know, you just know yourself.
Maybe it forces you to take something off, you know, like you know, when you're supposed to dress yourself and look in the mirror and then remove one item.
Maybe.
You know, like, so it's maybe it's like taking off the earrings or something.
The other thing I know about myself, and when I was talking about like the going through several drafts, is I've been both an editor and a writer. I was an editor for years at New York Magazine, and I loved being an editor. And part of the reason I love being an editor is in a completely different emotional state of mind. An editor is a cool, sadistic position of control. It's not your byline.
Right.
And you can look at things like Tom Cruise in Minority Report and be like moving them around and all this kind of stuff. I was editing a whole section. I was involved with, you know, I loved headlines and all that kind of thing. Once I became a writer, it's basically like I, who had been a reasonably like responsible, connected, organized person, just being a writer means at whatever level, going from being a grandiose self-involved baby to be, you know, like from self-love to self-loathing, and you have these weird like mood swings, and then there's this kind of weird egotism to it, and it's just I find it a more bizarre emotional state. And so part of the whole thing is basically keeping that in check enough that I can actually also be productive and enjoy what I'm doing. But part of it is just because I've been writing for years and years, I feel like I know tricks to compensate for the downside of that. And part of it is, as I was saying, I was like, when I get stuck, and Clive, my husband, says this to me, he's just like, you've been stuck before. This happens every couple of columns. You will fix it. And then I do the thing I do. And actually, I go to a local bar is what I do. It's like late at night. I'm just like, I will just sit down with my computer until I fix this.
Wow.
And then I just rewrite and rewrite and rewrite until it's fixed. Because it has to go in.
It's a kind of faith based, you know, based on experience. And I think, you know, other people we know who have trouble with writer's block, get into a thing where they go like, well, that's the last song I'm ever going to write. Like, they don't have a faith, but I've started to develop that, like, I figured out all these other songs, you know, mm-hmm. like I figured out how to fix them. So I'm probably going to figure out this one.
It's interesting that you frame that as faith, because I think that the way that it manifests is actually like a faith in the science.
Yeah.
You've developed these strategies. You've worked with these materials before.
Yeah.
You've arranged them in ways that have satisfied you before.
Yeah.
You know, you just start doing the math again or the science again. You know, yeah. You start putting things
together.
Well,
I saw you appear in a panel talking about songwriting, and I found it so thrilling because, first of all, I love music. Like, I'm obsessed with songwriting just as a fan person, and specifically with lyrics. Like, I like music as well, but I'm very into lyrics. And hearing people talk about enjoying songwriting was so pleasurable for me, because the thing of the specific craft of creating a lyric and what you were talking about, I remember, which is the relationship between the music and the song and the effect that it has on a person, was so satisfying. It was weird because I was thinking about my own writing a little bit, and I was like, it is an odd thing to think about somebody reading your stuff and how they respond to it versus just what works for you.
Yeah.
I don't know, but that thing where I'm like, I've done this enough that I will be able to do this. And actually, what I'm really trying to do, and I don't know whether this is true with songwriting, but there's with my columns, I'm trying to get to a stage where past the mess, where I'm like, is this hacky or cliched? Is this elegant? Like, whatever. Like, there's a point where I'm reading it as an editor.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Like, there's just a point, and you can
switch into an objective mode.
Yeah. And there's the last column that I wrote that was about Gentleman Jack and Killing Eve. It was sort of, I had a medium struggle with that column because I couldn't quite get some of the ideas right. But I was looking at the end of it, and it really was this thing where I was like, I was just looking at it very coolly, and I was like, the last paragraph is not sharp enough. Like, I was just like, it needs some new idea.
Yeah.
And then I just walked to the cafeteria and thought of this comparison thing that I did to other female criminals that are out there, and like the reason that there's something appealing about the character on Killing Eve versus other serial killers. And I put it in, and I wrote a good last sentence, and then I was like, I fixed it.
Yeah.
But the thing is, it was weird because I was like, I fixed it because I was regarding it almost like I was trying to fix a broken VCR.
Yeah.
Like, it was like a completely technical problem.
Yeah. You have to do that sometimes. I think that, you know, we've discussed this as regards songwriting, specifically finding rhymes and things too, because you might have a thematic idea about where the song is going lyrically. But if you bump up against something where you really want to find a rhyme and you find the right rhyme, but it changes the direction of the theme of your song, you can often wind up in a better place altogether.
Yeah, sometimes
that's like the third option.
But I love that you care about rhyme because it's so meaningful to me. And there are songs that I listen to when I'm stuck. Like, it's some of them, the corniest one I listen to is the Indigo Girls' Hammer and a Nail, which is a very corny song about creativity, but it has worked for me for decades, so why not listen to it?
There you go.
The other one is Extraordinary Machine. I love that song. Fiona Apple's song, Extraordinary Machine, because, I mean, it is actually a song about the fact that sometimes it takes a long time to finish something. and it's a song, you know, and obviously that relates to her thing, but it's such a funny song because it's a song to me about like arrogant pride in your own weird creative tools, where it's just saying I'm an extraordinary machine. I actually listened to that song while I was in labor, actually, because I felt like there's something about the song that I found very inspiring, because it was saying other people may look at you and think that you're being a baby or you're taking too long or you're not doing this right, but I just keep going and it always happens and I will magically have this thing come out right. Like and it will be original.
Mm.
Like somehow that's how I read the song. But there's something, I don't know. There's a bunch of different songs.
That's a great sentiment, actually.
Yeah.
That's really nice. I don't think I ever really realized that. It's a really nice sentiment.
Yeah.
Do you listen to other music when you're trying to write music?
No. I will.
For a specific brief, sometimes I will. If I have an idea that I might not be cracking through to, but I know I can inform it by checking in with something else, I might do that.
Mm-hmm. To take stuff from, you know, I mean, or as like a place to start. For musical stuff, I'll listen to other songs from musicals and go, let's start with that rhythm and see if that gives me an idea. But that's like in a really specific way. But I don't listen to the song for like inspiration.
Sure.
I don't get into the song. I take a piece of the song and see if part of that would work. Like starter dough for a new loaf.
What a terrible that makes total sense. Is the nice thing about being a writer is there are a lot of writers who listen to music as, and then they're, the thing is, because they're not music writers, there's this freedom to getting to, I always love when people write books and they, in their acknowledgments, thank a specific album for getting them
through. I would think it would be a danger to listen to music while you're writing prose, because the music is providing an emotional underpinning that now you may leave out of your writing.
That's true.
You know what I mean? Like, I would think that you'd want to do it straight.
You know, I have a million different music mixes, and then I like walk around listening to them. And some of it is just emotional. They're just helping me feel better if I feel stuck. So it's like a more straightforward thing than being inspired by the music.
This is light, but I have been thinking about the idea that, and I wonder if you have an opinion on it, is prestige television just soap opera with bigger production values?
Yeah. I mean, you know,
that's not to diminish prestige television.
No,
it's to raise soap opera.
The thing is, prestige,
way,
like,
you know?
So many markers that were sort of useful phrases in some way, but then degenerated and then started, like, eventually, what did it mean? Did it mean that it cost a lot of money? Did it mean that it looked fancy like a movie? Did it mean that it was serious and felt luxurious? And like, because sometimes, you know, prestige means what it sounds like, which is that it makes the person who's watching it seem like they're of a higher social class and like they're educated.
Sure.
Like dinner party conversation TV that you can feel proud of talking about with adults. So I've never liked the category because it means that people can't appreciate Jane the Virgin. But is it just, you know, people would say that about Mad Men. And I have to say, I thought it was unfair, but it was unfair on both sides. Like, first of all, Mad Men was doing all sorts of crazy things that were not just about the plot or the, you know, that were about the visuals, that were about the humor, that were about the historical aspects. I mean, it was cheap to reduce it to just like, well, it's about domestic experiences. But the real problem is that the word soap opera, I could go into a whole thing. Yeah. I'm obsessed with, I wrote a whole piece about, I wrote this column on cliffhangers that I didn't include in the book, but I kind of wish I could, but I think that the essay is flawed, like the structure of it's flawed, but that's because I came to my big insight way too late in the writing. And the insight was this, I was like, why has TV changed? Well, one reason, as most people can see, is that serialized storytelling is different than episodic storytelling that TV used to be. And TV used to be episodic because it was run out of order, and also you just watched it live and you had to have each one, you know, each sitcom or each drama had to just last an hour or a half hour. But now you could have the characters change over time, you could have their relationships change, you could have all sorts of cliffhangers and things. But soap operas always did that. Soap operas at the beginning of TV, there was no serialized television except for soap operas, which were on during the daytime, were commercial, were for women, and were considered the most degraded form of TV.
Right.
And soap opera itself was the DNA of ambitious television.
Right.
So it literally, there were these breakthrough things that came through soap opera. Now, daytime soap operas there was a reason people looked down on them. They were moralistic and they were formulaic, and people who wrote them were ashamed of writing them, you know, which was a whole other thing.
They had to constantly come up with new, very dramatic things that happened that then got more and more ridiculous because you just run out of it. That's the resurrection plot. But that stuff is wonderful because that is the magical part of narrative.
That's what happened. Yeah. That's Battlestar Galactica with it being in space. You know?
And also just, there's this whole problem with part of it's gendered, but part of it is just this thing where it's like worldly things, action things, violent things are all somehow have to be superior to the stuffy, uncomfortable, emotional, sexual,
things
domestic
that
sphere.
In the house.
Yes.
Things that's women's territory.
Sex, relationships, families.
Degraded. Yeah.
So there's already this sort of just smear of condescension that's placed on top of it. But there breakthrough shows that changed TV came through soap opera. Sometimes as like Soap. Like, do you remember that show Soap?
Yeah, of course,
Soap transformed TV. I remember when I was watching it, I was like, wait, there are like previews and then they're joke previews, but then they show it going from the plots change over time. And then also Mary Hartman.
Yep.
Which was, you know, this angry response to soap operas because Norman Lear was like, television is very commercial. But it was this experimental, almost avant-garde TV show, but it only worked because it was attached to the body of a soap opera. Mm-hmm. So I actually think the real problem is not so much like, are they secretly soap operas, but that people should be able to celebrate the power of soap opera as a structural you know, like the roller coaster that you attach what you're doing to, yeah. which, you yeah. know, has changed TV. It's what's made it exciting. I mean, there are other things that come in too, like serialized Westerns and things like that from movies that affected Breaking Bad and things, but people don't think of something like Breaking Bad as a soap opera,
right.
even though it has cliffhangers and extreme stylizations. Anyway, I need to assign myself a different essay about soap operas because...
Yeah, this is a whole
it's
show.
It's such an interesting subject,
show.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, it's great.
Yeah, we'll talk about this off.
Okay. All my children here.
Well, mine was
General
like
Hospital.
Late 80s, One Life to Live. Was like, it was, you know, recommended to me by someone I was seeing at the time. And it was like, you got to watch this.
Oh, that's great.
Like,
that's
and I was like, you are 100% right after this. And I kept watching it for a long time. And it was, you know, it's interesting in terms of what you said about the things that happen in the house is like women's topics and whatnot. I mean, I was blown away with what they were dealing with in terms of sexual violence and things. On it was
there was
really
some real
heavy
stuff.
And really well handled.
There was some real stuff, like even in the 80s or like even in the 70s.
70s TV is a whole other subject. 70s TV was amazing and is weirdly. I was very much of the mindset when I started writing about TV, the sort of bland thing where you're like, well, TV has gotten better, so therefore that means that it has gotten better, gone uphill. That's really not the case with most art, but 70s TV did things that nobody does now. Like, it just had an aggression and wildness and directness about lots of things, including violence and sex and race and gender in a way that would seem shocking to people. And so when you watch those old shows, you're like reminded of how like jaunty and jazzy people got to be on network television. It's crazy.
All right, I got
you. Okay. Right. Well, Emily Nussbaum, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. It was great talking
fantastic.
To you guys.
Fantastic. Thank you. Well, thank you so much for listening. If you have been enjoying our podcast, The Art of Process, you know, subscribe and like and tell people about it, all the things you do, it would help us out.
Our goal with this is to help ourselves get our own heads in order, but we hope that it might be beneficial to you too. So if you know some other people in your life.
Yeah, if you're an artist, if you know artists, if you want to be an artist and this is helpful to you, spread the word.
Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Please become a member of MaximumFun.org. Pre-order, or if this is after June 19th, 2019, just go out and get Emily Nussbaum's book of essays titled I Like to Watch, and we will see you next time.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.